Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week, we're talking about the new St. Vincent album, Mass Seduction, and the latest Louis Theroux documentaries on the BBC.
Caroline has also watched the HBO miniseries Big Little Lies for the first time, so she'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously Pod. We're just sifting through the emails as we ordinarily do.
Yeah, and there's a complete mixed bag. People are still sending us feminist Western suggestions, so thank you very much for that.
My God, who knew there were so many?
I know, it's actually very heartening. But a slightly less heartening but very important email has come in from Hannah, who asks, after your discussion of problematic faves, I was wondering if you were planning to mention Harvey Weinstein on the podcast at all. This is not to forget or minimalise the experiences of anyone who has reported being assaulted by him, but I found myself preoccupied with why these accusations against him have stuck and resulted in real life-changing, tangible consequences when accusations against many others do not appear to have harmed their careers very much at all. And then she goes on to say, my initial thoughts were that maybe as a producer rather than actor or director, he is less visible and therefore less insulated by crowds of adoring fans, but I don't know enough to know if that has any weight. So yeah, this has been like a sort of cataclysmic event in the sort of Hollywood film world in the last 10 days or so, hasn't it?
Yeah, and basically the accusations against Harvey Weinstein, who is a film producer and studio executive. So he's the executive of a studio called The Weinstein Company, which has produced so many movies like The King's Speech and Paddington and loads. And he's also been behind films like Shakespeare in Love, just so many. The accusations against him are kind of wide-ranging and from multiple sources suggesting that he's groped women over the years. There's even 3 accusations of rape in the Ronan Farrow New Yorker piece. So I think that is part of what Hannah's talking about, which is that there's just so many people who have come forward with claims against Weinstein, right? And it means that it's very, very difficult for people to pretend that, you know, well, we don't know what really happened, or to say, you know, that's for that family to deal with, that's behind their closed doors, because it's just so many people and so many very, very famous people and so many people that he worked with. It's just a real stain against him that he can't deny.
Yeah, definitely. It's not something he can brush off. The magnitude of it is such now that the Metropolitan Police in the UK are investigating various historic allegations of rape and so on. You know, it's now a lot bigger than something that just like a statement from a studio could brush off. So yeah, I think that's one thing. But I also do think she's got a point that whilst we can all acknowledge in an abstract sense that he's a very powerful producer and executive, I don't think anyone is like a fan of Harvey Weinstein. It's not like you see his face on screen and you feel invested in his personality and his narrative and stuff. And therefore, it's not necessarily difficult for people to accept that he individually may have done these things. Whereas, like we talked about in the problematic fave episode, I think it is harder when you feel like you have a personal investment in the personal art, you know, of someone to then go, oh, okay, right, but they are a really, really bad person who's harmed a lot of people.
Yeah. Totally. And the thing with accusations against Woody Allen, Roman Polanski, Bill Cosby, they've had such massive existing fan bases that nobody wants to be the person to say, hey, this guy that you love is actually terrible. Whereas I guess people have felt a little bit more able to say that about Weinstein. I think one thing that I wrote a piece about for the New Statesman is that Weinstein's studio has struggled in the last 2 years to actually produce the kinds of films that it is known for producing. So that might play into, like, it's obviously not the whole story, but that might play into a little bit of why these accusations have come out now, because some of his power had slipped from his fingers in the last couple of years. So it maybe made people feel more able to say things about him without losing massive important jobs. And the conversation about sexual assault has just moved on, which is the one kind of positive, I guess, that you can glean from this mess of a situation, is that people do feel slightly more able to come out and say, this happened to me and it was this man that did it. But yeah, it's a whole mess. It's very complicated.
It's a huge mess. And I don't know about you, but I've found social media generally very upsetting in the last week or so, just because, you know, lots of people quite rightly sharing their own experiences, which is hard to read, but also an awful lot of other people telling them that they shouldn't be sharing those experiences or shouldn't think what they do and all that kind of thing. Whilst I am pro all of this being out in the open, definitely, it also does expose quite how far there is to go in this kind of discourse.
Totally.
Which makes me feel a bit weary, to be honest.
It's just been relentless. Obviously, it's great to see people having these conversations, but also sometimes you have to take a break from it because it is really, really exhausting, you know, especially for people who've had any sort of experience with sexual assault, which is almost every woman I know, I think. So it's been a difficult week to be on the internet and consuming pop culture. So I guess that's all we have to say on the guy.
Yeah.
Shall we move on?
Let's move on. Let's move on to something more cheerful.
So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is an album. Mass Seduction is the fifth album by St. Vincent, the stage name of singer-songwriter Annie Clarke. It came out on 13th of October 2017, and despite being hailed as more of a pop crossover work, it has been described as having a grimy, acid aesthetic by BuzzFeed. The first single, New York, is unusually for St. Vincent a piano ballad and was produced by Jack Antonoff, who's also worked on recent records with Lorde and Taylor Swift.
New York isn't New York without you, love. So far and a few blocks to be so low. And if I call you from first, where the only other sucker in the city who can handle me.
So I have been listening to this album for a few weeks because I was lucky enough to get it early, and I'm not someone who's known much about St. Vincent or really had much of a familiarity with her other records. But there was quite a lot of hype around this record, and it was really sort of being described as her best work yet in a few pieces that I read. So I did check it out, and I have to say, it's amazing. It's very layered and very textured and very complex, which makes it very hard to talk about, I think, because I haven't got that extent of music vocabulary. But I know that I like it. And I know that it's kind of confusing and amazing and atmospheric.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I have a bit of, I think I really liked her previous album, but I don't really know much about the first three. And I was also quite excited about this. I've been on a really good roll with music in the last few months. I mean, in terms of new music, I'm not often that good at like keeping up with the new music. So I was quite excited for this. And yeah, I don't know. I was talking to a friend in the pub about it last night, and I was like, I know that I like it, and I know that it's different to everything else I'm listening to at the moment, but I'm not doing a very good job of explaining why that is. I do think, though, that I may be a little bit overdosed on Jack Antonoff at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I don't think his presence is very heavy on this record.
It's not. I mean, it's noticeable in the first single, New York, which does have some, I don't know, I listened to it for the first time and I was like, oh, this sounds like Lorde in some ways.
Yeah, it's got the kind of like bouncy keys that some of Swift and Lorde have in their singles that are produced by him. But I think overall the album is so much grimier and more distorted than anything Jack Antonoff. I mean, I know that he's someone who uses a lot of layering of sounds and, you know, weird noises, which we've learnt from that Lorde Song Exploder episode we mentioned on the podcast. He does, you know, use all these different random snippets and put them together to create a greater depth of sound. But aside from that similarity, I think this is just so much weirder and like more discordant than anything he normally works on. So for me, I didn't feel overwhelmed by his appearance. Mm.
Annie Clark is an incredible guitarist, among other things. And whilst you get more of that on previous albums and also often live, you know, she plays incredibly live, I feel like on this album, I don't know, a lot more of it is in the background and, as you say, looped and treated and interesting filters have been put on it. I don't know how you describe those things, but it's in some places you're like, well, that probably is a guitar, but I don't really know how, which is so interesting.
Yeah, one thing I really liked on this is how sometimes certain instruments sound like something else. So there are lots of, I think one of my favorite things about this album is that there are moments that feel very, for want of a better word, transcendent and almost religious, because there are these moments where you get, I don't know, like synths that sound like violins and guitars that sound like pealing bells. And then you do get actual violins and the occasional bell and things like that in there as well. But you get this ethereal sort of note. I've noticed them on like Hang On Me.
Yes, where very kind much.
Of like, yeah, it opens the album, but towards the end of that song, there's a lot of, she says like, come all you wasted, wretched and scorned, you know, and it kind of has that come all ye faithful almost vibe. There are lots of kind of spoken word little bits, like on Los Ageless and Savior, that feel to me a bit like confessions, if that makes sense. And like the end of Smoking section where she says it's not the end over and over again, that feels very like transcendent to me. And the instrumentation is a huge part of giving you that feeling.
Our friend and previous Seriously contributor, Laura Snapes, wrote an amazing profile of St. Vincent for BuzzFeed a few weeks ago. And there was a quote in that that really came back to me when I was listening to the music. Laura writes, she hoped there will be no mistaking her intent with her new record, which is, quote, so first person and sad.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely that. I like all the stuff about identity on this record. And I think sometimes women, especially queer women, can always be like pigeonholed as writing about identity. So I don't want to do that to her, because it's not something that's like a strong note on every song on the album or anything. But there are just a couple of songs where I kind of felt those questions bubbling to the surface. So Happy Birthday, Johnny, where she sings about being accused of acting and, you know, doing things for show, no true charity. And then there's that line where she sings, Annie, how could you do this to me? Which feels very, I don't know, raw and personal, and kind of it breaks the fourth wall and breaks through the rest of that song. And you kind of get it even on like Savior, which is a song that's basically about like sexual role play, where she's dressing up as like a nurse and a teacher and a nun and a policewoman. And she says, like, none of this shit fits about all these different outfits. And, you know, it can feel a bit heavy-handed to be like, oh, yeah, like, she can't find her true self or whatever. But there's some nice playing with those questions of, like, public persona and private persona on this record.
It's completely fascinating. And I'm slightly hesitant talking about it almost, because I don't feel like I know all of it yet. Even though I've been listening to it nonstop, I still feel like it has places to go in my mind. But that's what's really beautiful about it. And this is maybe slightly controversial, as much as I do love Lorde's melodrama, and I think I always will, I think I'm getting more out of this, if that makes sense. I don't know, it's going deeper for me, which is quite exciting. I haven't felt like that really with an album for ages.
I think as well we should mention that she is just like an amazing performer and vocalist, and like the range of emotions that she brings to the table on this record, it goes from like really, really playful on Pills with that kind of like nursery rhyme melody that she's kind of singing in this, you know, very sing-song voice, and then these moments where her voice is barely there at all and it's like cracking and disappearing. And she very much is in this tradition. I know she's compared to like Bowie and people like that all the time, but there is something that feels very like Prince or something about her, where she's able to do all these different things and with such kind of glamour. and make something really sad seem really like aspirational, which is not the right word, because, you know, a lot of this record is really sad. And, you know, there are lines about people overdosing in bathtubs that, you know, are not glamorous at all. But she's so beautiful and so, I don't know, just there's just something so exciting about her that it's kind of irresistible.
The Pitchfork review of this album actually does a really good job of interrogating that whole St. Vincent is this era's Bowie, etc. thing, which is very interesting, and I would recommend people go and read it. But there was a bit in it where the writer says, well, if St. Vincent is Bowie, then this album is her Let's Dance,
which
I thought was a really interesting point, sort of placing it in progression of an artist's work.
There was also a really great Dazed piece that people should check out that was all about how she fits into the tradition of glam rock, specifically glam rock that's kind of to do with androgyny, and how glam rock is often about men feminizing themselves, and how she kind of fits into that tradition as a woman who's not doing that. That was really interesting as well. So lots of links to go in the show notes.
Sageless, the winter never comes. In love, sageless, the mothers milk their young. But I can keep running, though I can keep running.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Now we're going to talk about Louis Theroux's latest series of documentaries for the BBC, which is titled Dark States and focuses on social problems in three different American cities. He's looking at heroin addiction in Huntington, West Virginia, sex trafficking in Houston, Texas, and murder in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Each film follows through as he spends time with different people affected by the problem and is full of his trademark hands-off interview style.
Police Department search warrant! Police Department search warrant!
How much would you say is the street value of that heroin?
About $3,000 possibly, and the heroin maybe more. But you can see how much money's there. We're seeing so much dope that to us, that's not that big a deal. I mean, that's how bad our problem is.
That's another overdose.
By now, I was several weeks into my stay, and throughout the city, the ravages of heroin were apparent on a daily basis.
It looks all perky now.
Yeah, it's Narcan.
Riding on the back of the overprescription of painkillers, heroin has ripped the heart out of Huntington, destroying lives indiscriminately. While the overstretched city workers do their best to turn the tide.
Those people in that car. You see how they were looking at us? Step out.
Do you have a problem with opiates or heroin?
Yeah, I struggled with it.
Yeah.
Like a contagion, it has left almost no one's life untouched.
So the first one was this one about heroin addiction in West Virginia. Huntington is what they call a tri-state town, right? Because it's kind of on the intersection between these three states. And one of the things that I thought is great about this look at heroin addiction in Huntington is the way that he kind of explains how that is a hangover from the town's very specific history, which is that it's an industrial town and had a lot of people doing manual labor and sustaining injuries at work and medicating with prescribed painkillers. For many people in the town, that's the first step to becoming a serious drug addict.
Yeah, I found that so interesting, especially when he was talking to someone from the emergency services who was explaining that I think she said something like 80% of the people they subsequently deal with who overdose and stuff started out with legal prescriptions for pain medication. And then they talk through the film about how pharmaceutical companies massively exploited people's dependency on things like Percocet by encouraging doctors very heavily to prescribe them. And then you end up with someone who maybe was already vulnerable in the start or maybe wasn't, but who runs out of their legal pain meds and so then has to go looking for something else because, you know, what other options have they got?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you end up in this situation where I think she said there are 49,000 people living in Huntington and in the last year they've had 1,100 people die from overdoses.
Wow.
Which is completely astonishing. But then, as with, I feel like, all Louis Theroux documentaries, his modus is to show you, not necessarily to tell you. So they do a lot of driving around the town and you can see in the landscape the former industrial past that you mentioned and the kind of urban decay. And then, as ever, he focuses in on a few different stories.
I think what's so great about his work is, or this particularly this example, is that he finds people from very varied backgrounds. And I think ended up being the thing that hit home to me the most, is how, by showing us people from all these different backgrounds, how it was really indiscriminate, this addiction. And we do meet a woman who's in recovery, who seems to be doing very well with her recovery, who's pregnant. Her story is very much one of, like, having everything she needed, but also having access to her father's painkillers, because everyone else was doing it from when she was about 12 years old, taking those painkillers. And you just think, 12, like, people don't even have a chance. Nobody's mature enough to resist an addiction at 12. If the social conditions are there that everyone is, that you know, is doing it, and you have extremely easy access to free drugs and no one to tell you how dangerous it is and no one to help you to stop, then what chance do you have, really?
That was something I thought was so interesting about this. The fact that we see that woman who, as far as we can tell, comes from a pretty stable middle class family. Ditto the woman who's maybe the main focus of the program, called Cotillia, who at one point we go and visit her great uncle who brought her up, and he lives on this really nice farm out in the country. And he obviously loves her very, very much and, you know, would do anything for her. So he's really, in a very subtle way, busting the myth that, oh, drug addicts are like society's dropouts. Yeah. Lots of other social problems lead them to this point. And this film kind of says, no, drug addiction is so powerful that it can overcome anything else good that you might have going on.
Totally. I think one of the stories that really I found absolutely amazing is the story of this guy who was married and deep in a heroin addiction with his wife, and had been in jail for, like, stealing a laptop, and had really been an addict for a serious amount of time. And we meet him in this documentary helping current addicts and trying to help them at least live a safe life, if not get on to recovery. The fact that he recovered from a heroin addiction that serious, and he's a year sober when we talked to him in the documentary, I just thought was the most ridiculous achievement. It's like incredible. And as you say, Louis has this very hands-off interview style. So there's this guy in the back of his car telling him that he's been a year sober after, like, over a decade of not being able to do anything, barely even leave his home or, you know, his tent or whatever. And he's like, not like, oh, congratulations or anything. He's just sat there like silently. And I wanted to scream and be like, he's done the world's most amazing thing. Tell him. But he didn't, because that's his style.
But that's kind of Louis' style, isn't it? So yeah, at the same time, someone's like, oh yeah, I've been a year sober. I had to leave my own wife in order to achieve that. He's like, oh, how did that feel? And then at the same token, when Catilia's telling him that her boyfriend, who is also her drug dealer, like, keeps her like she's a pet and she can't get away from him even though he beats her up, he's like, oh, that's sad, you know.
Yeah,
he's sort of weirdly emotionless.
Yeah, totally.
A lot of the time, which I know is for the point of showing you rather than putting his own feelings or narrative on things, but occasionally, like, yeah, with that example of the guy who'd managed to get sober, you feel like, well, you could say well done.
That was a really harrowing moment that you just mentioned in the documentary, where Catilia asks her boyfriend to sort of leave the room because she says she's embarrassed or whatever, and then as soon as he leaves the room, she's sort of like, you know, this guy hits me and I wouldn't be in this situation if I wasn't so addicted to heroin and if I didn't need him to supply it for me and him to pay my rent and get me good quality drugs and, you know, so on. That conversation comes up a couple of times in the documentary. And this is where I start to feel a bit sometimes nervous about Louis Theroux documentaries, because he does say that Catilia gave him permission to do this, but he just like straight up asks this guy like, oh, you hit Catilia, you know, you broke her nose, didn't you? And you worry about what happens when they go home that night after doing that interview. And I know that the point of these documentaries is not to help people, but to shed light on a problem and hope that there's like structural help as a result. But I felt very uncomfortable in some of those scenes because I worry about how much support they're giving their interviewees outside of what we see. And the answer to that might be loads. I just don't know. And so you ethically worry about these people, and you worry about people who are giving consent to things like being filmed doing drugs and stuff when they're so vulnerable and they're so deep in an addiction, and a lot of the time they're actually high, so they can't give properly fully formed consent on camera. And how does that work?
Yeah, I thought that there's one scene where he's shadowing the emergency workers and they respond to a call of an OD of a woman who's like lying on the floor, and you know, they're helping her, and I was like, wow, I could she have said yes to this in full knowledge? I don't know. It's definitely a very important film to watch. I definitely feel like I understand a lot more about drug addiction than I did before I watched it. But yeah, it, as you say, with Louis Theroux, it's often quite on the edge of what you think is maybe appropriate or sensible.
Yeah, and a lot of those questions come up in the second episode, which is about sex trafficking in Houston. And that scene with Catilia talking about her abusive boyfriend who she's only staying with because she's got a serious drug addiction and needs somewhere to live, there are parallels to that in this sex trafficking one, which is a lot of Louis speaking to women who are in very, very difficult situations where they're semi in love with these pimps who control their entire lives. And they'll be talking about the abusive relationship they have with their pimps on camera. And I worry so much. You know, in one case, the pimp's in jail, so it feels kind of more okay. But in another, he's not. And you really worry for her safety at several points in the documentary. That's when those questions of ethics really worry me a bit.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one yet, but I am very much intending to.
Yeah, it's very dark. It's very hard to watch. And sex work is obviously a very, very thorny issue in particular. So you don't want this guy to like go in and be like, all of you are making terrible choices. And there is a moment where he says, you know, I feel convinced there's one woman who's very, very keen to let Louis know that she's very happy with her choice. And she makes a lot of money and she likes what she does. But Louis doesn't bite for a second. And he says several times, you know, like, I felt convinced that her choices were wrong, but unable to explain to her why. You know, so that's a whole nother issue where that is extremely complex and one that I don't have all the knowledge to come to a proper conclusion on. And then the final one is going to be on murder in Milwaukee. And I don't know how that's going to play out in Wisconsin, but I'm excited to watch it. And I, even though I have all these problems and questions about Louis Theroux documentaries, I am always really excited to watch them. So we'll see how the series develops. Thank you. So last week, I recommended that Caroline watch the HBO miniseries Big Little Lies, starring Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Shailene Woodley, Laura Dern, all the big gals. Caroline, what did you make of this creeping backwards murder mystery, I guess?
Yeah, it's such an interesting structure in the sense that, so there are seven episodes and you get this flickering cut between this beautiful, sunlit, rich people life in Monterey, California. And then without warning, it kind of flicks into brief bits of scenes of police interrogations and murder scene investigation and, you know, detectives giving press conferences and all this kind of stuff. So you know from the start that something dreadful has happened, but you don't necessarily know what or who. But people in the interrogation scenes keep using phrases like, so are we calling this a murder then? And stuff like that. So you're like, someone's been murdered, but I don't know who.
Yeah.
And obviously it's intentional. The contrast between the very sort of glossy, rich lifestyle and something as horrible and horrific as murder is there on purpose to make you feel off balance and confused. But yeah, it's really effective. And I have to say, to start with, that was what kept me watching, because I didn't immediately really connect with any of the characters or, I don't know. I think if it was just the like Monterey scenes and like Reese Witherspoon playing a sort of slightly spoilt woman, stay at home mum in her wealthy house, etc., etc., I would have been like, I didn't watch The Real Housewives of LA for a reason. I don't really like this. But because you know it's got this undercurrent of thriller and something else,
yeah,
it becomes intriguing for that.
I have to say, how dare you? I absolutely love Reese Witherspoon in this. Madeline Martha McKenzie, my hero. I just think she's such a brilliant character. And in the first episode, I do think there's something of the, she just comes across as like a bit of a bitch and like maybe not that interesting a character. And as it goes on, she just becomes, I just love her. She's like so, Reese Witherspoon is brilliant in this very comic performance as this woman who has a perfect life and is like very, very controlling and very aggressive, but also has like a real kind streak in her and a real like, you know, obsession with defending the underdog, whether that's a play that no one wants to put on or the single mum who's moved into the area or what. You know, she's got this streak in her that's kind of about justice, but she just gets some great lines. And I really like when she says something like, she says, she like loses it on the phone and she says like, fuck you on the head or something. It's just so funny. I loved her. She's my idol, my queen.
It was interesting seeing this so soon after seeing her in Home Again.
Yeah.
Because although obviously the two roles are different, I did think there was an extent to which her character in Big Little Lies is kind of like if her character in Home Again had made a sequence of different decisions, she could have ended up in this situation. I don't know.
She's just so, yeah, so like sparky. And then there's just so many great performances in this. Zoe Kravitz plays Madeline's ex-husband's new wife, the kind of stepmother to her children. And she's beautiful and like really good at yoga and does boxing self-defense classes and stuff. And she's never painted as a villain, but she's irritatingly perfect, irritatingly new age LA person in the first few episodes. And I love how her character develops as well, as you begin to see that actually she is just someone who really cares about other people. And that's like not something to be sneered at. She is just, you know, a great person. All the female characters, Laura Dern, Shailene Woodley, Nicole Kidman, as the woman who is, you learn sort of very early on in the first episode, being abused by her husband. They're all really, really great performances. And I loved seeing so many of these women characters interact with each other. And I think that's sort of what made this more than just like an interesting murder mystery for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. While I was watching it, I was mentally comparing it a bit to Gone Girl and thinking, because when did Gone Girl come out? I feel like it book maybe came out 2 years ago, two, 3 years ago. Maybe this is putting too much on it, but I thought you can see how much we've moved on, that Gone Girl was the hit best-selling thriller and then big movie where all the focus was around this one female character and her role as the so-called cool girl and basically how she interacted with men. And then 3-4 years on, we've got Big Little Lies, which is about an ensemble female cast. And
that only came together because of, you know, Reese Witherspoon saying this has to be made and getting really behind it. Yeah.
I'm hesitant to say that progress only goes in one direction because we know it doesn't. But I don't know, it's an interesting to see them side by side like that.
Yeah. I love this. I think it's amazing. I think there's discussion about whether they're going to do a second season.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it would be impossible to do, but I would actually just watch a whole season of them just like hanging out in Monterey, all these women, because I just love them. Yeah, so the Daily Mail said it may return for season two in September, and CNN said it seems more likely in August. So I'll watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely a good recommendation. And I now see why everyone was so crazy about it a few months ago.
Yeah, of course. So for next week, we have an email recommendation, don't we? Which comes from Reese. Reese says he'd like to recommend a film I just came out of the cinema from seeing, God's Own Country. It's one of the most beautiful queer films I can recall seeing, and the way it tackles the interplay of homosexuality and masculinity seems, to me anyway, as a gay guy, the most realistic and un-Hollywood of any film I've ever seen. There are some really great performances, and it seems timely given the national shambles that is Brexit. I mean, that makes no sense to me as someone who hasn't seen the film, so I think we probably have to see it to understand what Reese means by that last bit.
I think I read a piece about it. I think it has a kind of immigration plot to
that
it.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's what he means.
I know lots of people that I really respect have adored this film, including Simran, who came on the podcast, and a few other people, and I've been wanting to see it for some time, and I just haven't made the trip to the cinema, so I'm really excited to do this for next week.
Yes, Reese actually emailed a while ago, but it's still on release in picture houses and various independent cinemas, I think, so we're going to try and catch it before it goes, and maybe you should do the same, listeners.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy, and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're SeriouslyPod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.